This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Several years ago, the inmate population in Mecklenburg jails was spiraling upward. The county was housing around 2,700 inmates a day. The recently built jail annex was already overcrowded, and $300 million was proposed to expand the jail. But the county took a different path. They opted to invest the money in improving the operation of the criminal justice system. Now the county is building on this by partnering with the U.S. Department of Justice on something called Justice Reinvestment. And here to talk about that and about what has happened as a result of their earlier decision to spend money not on bricks and mortar, but on system improvements are Tom Eberle, Andrew Murray, and Kevin Tully. Tom Eberle is Director of Criminal Justice Services in the Mecklenburg County Manager's Office. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Andrew Murray is the Charlotte District Attorney. We had your predecessor on here several times. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
And Kevin Tully is the Mecklenburg County Public Defender. Welcome back as well.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Good to see you. Take us back 5 years ago or so when you guys embarked on this plan. There was a lot of dissatisfaction within the system, both from those who were, users of the system from a citizen point of view, and also from within the system itself, from prosecutors, from defense attorneys, from judges. Why did you decide to take this less than normal course of not building jails and putting the money elsewhere into improving the system? I'm not sure who to ask that question of.
I'll start off with that. 5 years ago, the community was very dissatisfied with the criminal justice system. I think there was a lot of dissatisfaction between the relationship between the district attorney's office and the law enforcement agencies in particular, and just the processing of criminal cases, that it wasn't occurring fast enough, especially the more serious cases. And really, the county got at a crossroads because the jail population was increasing dramatically, like you said. And if you think of the jail population as a barometer, it's a good indicator of how well your system's performing. And when that jail population is going upward, there's something amiss. And then when it's going downward or it's stabilized, you know your system's functioning at a good level.
But when it's going upward, doesn't that mean crime is rising?
No, not necessarily, because crime has been going down nationwide as well as Charlotte for quite a bit of time.
Okay.
And so we're at a crossroads, and I've seen a lot of locations that have tried to build their way out of systemic problems, and it never works because if the system isn't functioning properly, those jail beds just get filled up again. Mm-hmm. And so the realization by the county manager, Harry Jones, was that we need to do something different, and we need to make changes within the system.
So this was Harry Jones' idea?
Very much so. Him and Michelle Lancaster decided to invest in the state criminal justice system.
Well, in America, at least this is the impression I have from just the fact that we have so many people in jail in America. I think we have one of the largest incarceration rates in the world. We like to build jails. We like to be tough. We like to put people away for doing bad things. So was this a hard sell to not do that, to not build yet another jail or expand the jail we just built?
I think so, because people will get accustomed to doing business in a certain way. And really what we're proposing was a different strategy and a different way of doing business. So that took some work in terms of trying to change perceptions. But ultimately, you know, we've had jails around for a couple centuries now, and they don't do what you expect them to do. They don't work.
Was this
different ideas?
I like to get that we have a prosecutor here and we have a public defender here. So I'd like to get your points of view on this. I would imagine, Kevin, that as a public defender, you favored this move. This was something that was probably something that you liked.
In general, yes, I had concerns. When you start talking about system performance and efficiencies, you can start talking about the criminal justice system as a business. And it can't be and nor should it be run as a business for a number of reasons. You know, we're not producing widgets. These are people's lives. But secondly, because in a business situation, you have a free market. And the free market dictates a lot of things in your business, how much money you ought to spend, how good a quality your product has to be. And in the criminal justice system, there is no free market. There is no competition. And so the danger is let's spend as little. You know, if you have no competition, why spend a lot of money? And why should your product have to be of any quality? Because you have no competition. So my concerns were – talk of system improvements being termed in business terms was I agreed we needed improvements. No client wants to sit in jail.
Right.
We found out there were a lot of clients sitting in jail that posed no real danger to the community, no threat to the community. And even those that had been determined to be some threat were waiting inordinate amount of times to have their day in court. So, yes, we welcomed it, but we wanted to go carefully.
So, Andrew Murray, you're the district attorney, and there's a lot of political pressure on the district attorney to prosecute criminals. And also a lot of pressure, I would think, from the citizenry to put people behind bars for breaking and entering and whatnot. So how did you view this initially?
Well, absolutely. First of all, I have to put it in perspective. I came into office in 2011, so this program started under my predecessor, okay. Peter Gilchrist. But I'm all on board that we had to do it better. It necessitated us finding efficiencies. Yes, being tough on crime is important, and those offenders that are violent, those offenders that are habitual, we need to have bed space for them. So the lower level offenders, those that need some assistance, need some drug treatment, those that aren't going to spend that much time. Prior, there were defendants staying in jail for 6 months when they were only going to get 3 months for that offense. That's three extra months they were sitting there when a judge wasn't going to give them 6 months. That's where we could find the efficiencies.
It's not fair to them, not fair to the taxpayer.
That's exactly correct. And so we had to find – we set up a fast track with the public defender's office. We worked together on a weekly basis finding those individuals that aren't a danger to the community that could use some alternative or are initially going to go on probation. We know that, and we're getting them through the system quicker, and we're getting them out and saving the taxpayers millions of dollars.
So we were going to have to pay $300 million to expand the recently built North Jail annex to the downtown jail. We didn't do that. We decided to take this route. How much has this cost?
We've invested about $4 million into the state justice offices, which includes the district attorney's office, who received the largest portion, the public defender's office, trial court administrator's office, and the clerk of courts. And we've also gotten involved with the treatment courts. When the state a couple years ago decided not to fund those courts anymore, the county stepped up and took those over.
So what you just said was, instead of spending $300 million, we spent $4 million?
Exactly. And the population went from 2,700 down to today it's 1,934. And it's interesting, too, because I was looking at the study that was done back in 2007. And it said by 2013, our jail population should be 3,300.
Mm. I have to say, Mike, that the citizens of this community – for that $4 million are getting the best bang for their buck that I can imagine. It's 3/100ths of the county's entire budget, and the savings that have occurred and the efficiencies. In my office, I've been able to have a specialty team that just handles domestic violence, a specialty team that just handles habitual offenders. We've made a difference with those minimum tax dollars here in this community.
Mm. And can I just point out also that during this time, the community ought to be aware not just that the population of the jail went down by 900, but that crime also went down. So it's showing that this can be done without risk to public safety.
Is this a groundbreaking program? If it was Harry Jones' idea, did he model it after some other program in some other city, or has this become like a model in and of itself for other cities to follow?
It is a model that's being advocated for across the country, and it's just really trying to make sure that you use the resources that you have as efficiently as possible and not become overwhelmed with the low-level cases that really create a lot of the volume.
So this all stemmed, if I'm not wrong, about out of a 2008 study that the criminal justice system here did, and it found a strong need for what was described in the study as a proactive and front-loaded case management system. What does that mean?
It means that somebody's looking at the numbers. It means that somebody's making certain that the cases are accounted for and that they're coming up to court date in a regular flow basis. They're not sitting around. Individuals aren't sitting in jail for 2 years just waiting on their case coming up.
And that was happening prior to this?
There were many, many.
Why? Doesn't that go against the constitutional right for a speedy trial?
Well, it does, but you can only do a speedy trial for as much as you have resources and court space to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you could bring a speedy trial motion, but when there's 100 in front of you, then as a prosecutor, I can't put you in front of the line.
So what you're saying is that there were a lot of cases that didn't need to go to trial, waiting to go to trial.
Yes. And some that needed to go to trial that just needed to get there quicker. But if we could get rid of those other backlog problems, we could get those cases to trial quicker.
That study also cited a need for bail reform and a need for control and reduction of jail resources. How so, bail reform?
We created a bail policy back in 2010 with Judge Lisa Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And that bail policy really changed the way we approach setting conditions of release. Before, you came in with a certain charge, you were given a certain bond amount. And instead, what we're doing is we're looking at the offender or the accused defendant and saying, okay, what are your risk factors? And based on those risk factors, what's a safe condition of release that we can impose?
So there's more leeway that the judge has than they used to have?
Well,
or a new set of rules?
More importantly, they have more information available to them so that they can make a really informed decision about what kind of bail should be imposed.
How has this impacted the population of people who are accused of these crimes? I hesitate to call them criminals because some of them are not. Some of them are falsely accused or are found innocent later on. But if you are a criminal, you like to game the system. So is this a system that can be gamed?
what you call gaming, we would call lawyering. But
I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the criminals here.
That's right.
And wait a minute. Is there a question?
That's another show. But I think what. Yes, has there been benefits to my clients? Absolutely. Those clients that could have been and should have been released on conditions of bond that posed no real risk to the community are now having that done. And what this does is allow them to keep jobs, keep their families together,
mm-hmm.
and the community benefits from that because people who lose their jobs, who lose their families, are at greater risk of reoffending. So it's a win-win situation. Also, those clients that want and rightfully are entitled to a jury trial are getting discovery faster. That's part of the front loading so that their lawyer can be prepared at an earlier stage in the process to give them good advice about what their options are and where they ought to go. So decisions are made earlier. And I think clients make better decisions when they're prepared earlier.
You mentioned, Andrew Murray, that you have regular meetings with the public defender's office, the district attorney's office does. So how unusual is that in a situation like this for the DA and the public defender's office to work together on a regular basis on these things?
You know, I can just tell you from the perspective of working here, we're working well together. My colleagues, we're the largest prosecutorial district in all North Carolina, and some of my colleagues are amazed at the rapport we have and the relationship that we have, that we work where we can together for efficiencies. And I will tell you, concerning the bond, I'm thrilled that the judge has all the information in front of them to make sure that they keep the public safe, and that is their past record, whether they've missed court dates before, the type of offense. But most of all, I just want to make certain that we protect the public, and that means sometimes that they're put on an electronic monitoring system.
And I'm going to take...
We have to stop. We'll pick up on the other side. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christopher Warren Green conducts the season finale, Beethoven's masterful Ninth Symphony, May 10th, 11th, and 12th in Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-1000. And Morningstar Mini Storage and Morningstar Marinas, solving the Carolinas household business and recreational storage needs for over 30 years. Information at MorningstarStorage.com and MorningstarMarinas.com. Well, it's a familiar story. A young girl, maybe 17, looks in the mirror at her 4'11", 71-pound frame and thinks she's fat. So she begins to starve herself. It's a condition we all know about now called anorexia, and teens have been fighting it for years. It's a familiar story, but for Harriet Brown, it was personal because it involved her daughter, and she shares that story along with her efforts to save her daughter, Kitty, Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama renews calls to close Guantanamo. Criminal charges are filed against three friends of the Boston bombing suspect, and the latest housing and unemployment numbers.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about justice reinvestment, in essence, here with Tom Eberle, who's Director of Criminal Justice Services in the Mecklenburg County Manager's Office. Andrew Murray is the Charlotte District Attorney, and Kevin Tully is Mecklenburg County Public Defender. I had to interrupt you going into the break, Kevin, because you wanted to clarify something on behalf of your clients about something that Mr. Murray was just talking about.
Yes, not a correction, but more of a rework. Mr. Murray said that we work well together. It's a common concern of our clients that we work with the district attorneys or with the system. I would rather term it, if you can agree to this, Andrew, we work well against each other. It is an adversarial system, which is another reason why it can't be run as a business. It's set up to be adversarial. But there are plenty of opportunities for us to meet, to discuss those situations where we have common ground and where it is a win for him and a win for my clients. And we spend a lot of effort finding those situations and spending time on those.
It certainly benefits you and your clients and the clients of attorneys who are paid by their clients to not spend 2 years in jail before they go to trial. And I guess there's a taxpayer benefit to that because we don't need to be housing innocent people or people who are going to ultimately be found innocent or serve much less time than the 2 years that they might have spent waiting for a trial. It's in our best interest. And do you see it that way as a prosecutor? Is it in your best interest to do that?
There's definitely a taxpayer.
It's a softer way. It's a softer approach to crime.
I'm not sure it's softer. It's just being more efficient. There is a taxpayer benefit, but there's also a benefit for me. I want to get closure. I want to get victims closure for their cases and get them restitution if they deserve restitution. And if the person is going to be convicted, then I want to get that for them so they can move on with their lives. And sometimes we talk about just getting it quicker because then an individual goes off a defendant if they're convicted and they're going to spend more than a year, they go off to Department of Corrections, to the state prison, mm-hmm. but they're out of the Mecklenburg County system. So when we're talking about efficiency, some of it is just efficiencies, getting them through our system and getting them on to do their time in another state system.
Okay.
It's really you have low-risk offenders and you have high-risk offenders, and it's not a one-size-fits-all criminal justice system. You really have to delineate between those two groups because you can take certain liberties with the low-risk people by putting them out on bond because they could be the person that just made a really dumb mistake, but they work at, Harris Teeter or somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And with those individuals, you can let them out, let the case proceed. The high-risk people, those are the ones you really want to focus on because those are people that the community is scared of. Mm-hmm. You want to save the jail beds for those types of individuals.
The National Association of Counties is involved in something called Smart Justice, Creating Safer Communities. Does what you've done fall under that umbrella?
I was just about to say that when you said, is this soft on crime, I was going to say again, to reword that, whereas the historical thinking is be tough on crime, I think the better choice is to be smart on crime. And that's exactly what this is. Through the county's help, we had a presentation of a national organization come in and talk about research that shows about sentencing, smarter sentencing, and what works and what doesn't work in keeping the public safe. And what works is learning who that person is standing before the judge and what are some of the circumstances that contributed to them coming into the system. And if the sentencing, if this person isn't going to prison, Is there a way, because sending people to prison under the old system of being tough on crime, mm-hmm. habitually just sending them to prison, wasn't working. Crime rates continued to rise. That doesn't work. It makes the community less safe. And what we learned was if you learn more about what are some of the factors driving them into the system, you can develop strategies that do make the public safe. And that's not being softer. That's being smarter.
Was that not working because a lot of the people who go to prison get out? They don't spend the rest of their lives there. And then when they get out, the prison has hardened them, made them more of a criminal than they were when they got in. So by doing it this way, by not sending them, that you can nip it in the bud, so to speak?
There's certainly recidivism from those that go to jail and get hardened. So when Mr. Tully says smart on crime, I think there's, from my perspective as a prosecutor, there's those that can use drug treatment, that need mental health treatment, mm-hmm. that we can get help and have made some bad choices and we can get back on track through some deferred program. There are those that are habitual offenders, that are violent offenders, that from my perspective, they, as long as they're in jail, they're not committing crimes. And so there's two levels, the lower level and those that need to go to prison from a prosecutor perspective. So I think that we're doing it well on being smart on those that need the help and those that do not, from my perspective, they need to go.
Why is this called justice reinvestment?
Well, justice reinvestment was created by the Department of Justice, and we were one of seven locations across the country selected to participate. And we received technical assistance from the Bureau of Justice Assistance. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you look at your criminal justice system, gather a bunch of data, and then analyze your policies and procedures and figure out how can we do things better. And if you can come up with new strategies that create savings, you take those savings, then you reinvest them back into the system so you can further along the advancement of the criminal justice system.
You did an assessment before you embarked on this in which you interviewed policymakers in this district, and five broad themes emerged: the need for improved prevention efforts of at-risk populations, the need for alternatives to address low-level offenses, the need to improve case processing immediately following an arrest, the need for attention to sentencing options, many of which we've already talked about here this morning, the need to improve reentry practices for offenders returning to the community. How many of these have been addressed? I know that some of them have, because we've already talked about it. For instance, the effort to improve prevention efforts of at-risk populations. How do you do that? Have we done it?
Well, we're just getting started, but okay. We're very excited about one of the projects that we've got going, and it's called FUSE. It's a Frequent User Service Enhancement Program. And what we've seen with the study that we've conducted was that we have 48 individuals that come into our jail repeatedly.
How many?
48.
48.
48 individuals that come to our jail. They consume about 21,000 jail bed days over a four-year period.
And I have a note on this. We spend $2.5 million on these people, on these 48 people.
Just these 48 people. Now, that's just for the jail.
You could pay them that money in salary, and they wouldn't be
– Exactly. You get that smart justice.
It's really –
you're getting it.
It's doing a lifetime of jail day at a time. That's what these low-level offenders are.
All right.
But, you know, there's other things. They're going to shelters. They're going to emergency departments. They're just consuming resources left and right across the community.
Who are these people, and why do they find themselves repeatedly in the system?
They're your chronic homeless, and they often have mental health problems with co-occurring substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. And our community struggles to work with these individuals because – you know, part of what they're dealing with is not amenable to services in a certain lifestyle. So it's our challenge to come up with a plan. And I mentioned the FUSE program. The idea there is to give them sustainable housing. Because if they don't have a place to stay at night, there's no way that you can help them deal with all the other things that are going on in their life. Mm-hmm. They need that bed. And we're going to create a program that's going to target those 48 individuals specifically and offer them a place to live.
What else? Because obviously they need something to help them get their life back on track, not just a place to sleep.
Absolutely. Once you get them that location, you can then wrap them up in services. You can make sure that they're receiving their medication like they should be. Just a lot of positive things that come from that.
We know from Sandy Hook there have been a lot of conversations about mental health services and about the problem is not guns. The problem is we're letting people with mental problems slip through the cracks. these are different kinds of mental problems and drug abuse problems, obviously, but are we equipped to handle these problems, whether it's 48 individuals or 148 individuals?
I think Charlotte's lucky that we have so many resources that currently exist. I think the challenge that we're facing is that these resources are scattered a little bit. We need to do a better job of connecting them together so that we can really focus in on the people that need those services.
What about reentry? Because part of the problem is that people do serve time and they do get out, and sometimes they're given no training, no preparation for life in the real world. They're exposed to much worse criminal activity and criminals than they themselves are. So what about getting them ready to come back into society?
That is another focus of the plan. We're in the early stages there in building something in Mecklenburg County, but you're absolutely right. You go to prison, and not only do all of those things happen that you talked about, but the things that were in place before you went that drove you in there or contributed to you going into the system are there also.
What would they be? Things. Give me some examples.
Examples are unemployment, mental health issues that have been misdiagnosed or unaddressed, substance abuse issues, domestic violence in the home. Mm-hmm. And so when you come back from prison, even if you haven't become hardened, even if you haven't been there a long time, those things still exist.
You just fall back into them.
And now you have a conviction, which is going to be a greater impediment. The collateral consequences of a criminal conviction are just numerous. I mean, you are disqualified from housing. You're disqualified from so much employment. So it's not surprising that so many people who come back from prison do reoffend.
Yeah, talk about that for a second, because that's something I don't think we think about very much, that we put these people away for committing crimes. They do their time. They come back. But they have this criminal record, and therefore they can't get a job. What do we expect them to do? How do we expect them to survive if it's not by robbing people or doing harm to the community? But then again, what's the answer to that? How do you take that criminal conviction and say, well, don't pay any attention to that to an employer? What do you do?
Well, you make efforts to educate the public that people can, and if their community is going to expect them to contribute, be contributing citizens, they have to have the opportunity to do so. There are government programs that give tax incentives for businesses to hire people with criminal records. There's a restaurant downtown, I believe, the King's Kitchen, I think it may be even a requirement there that you have a criminal record. And they're doing a great business. Right. So you can do it. It takes the public being aware and being willing to take some of that risk.
That's coming from the public defender. What's the point of view of the district attorney's office?
Well, certainly there are – having a conviction is an impediment, especially in this economy where many without convictions are having a difficult time getting a job. But from my perspective, those that commit violent crimes, those commit habitual crimes, that's the price of committing that crime is you are going to jail, you're going to have a felony on your record. Now, would I like somebody to – some program so they can get out and find their way back onto a path where they're not committing crimes and where they don't get back into, as Kevin says, back into the drug or back into domestic violence situations? Yes.
Let's take it out of the lawyer's purview and bring it back to a taxpayer, city, county manager's kind of purview. So, Tom Eberle, I mean, if you're faced with people who get out of jail who have criminal records and criminal conviction on their record and can't get a job, what's the county expect these people to do?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that they're individuals and people making mistakes, and there's a chance from this country to redeem yourself, and I think we can see that. I think that we need to do a better job working with the employers and trying to encourage them to not take such a harsh stance when, encountering someone that has a criminal record.
Does the county hire people with criminal records?
Sometimes, yes. Okay. Depends on the job.
You found that prosecuting crimes in this study that you conducted prior to embarking on this path, you found that prosecuting crimes involving just three charges, driving while license revoked, misdemeanor possession of marijuana, and possession of drug paraphernalia, not the drug itself, just the paraphernalia, cost $11.5 million a year to adjudicate. So what course of action did you decide to take on these three things, and how has it impacted the community if you've taken that action yet?
We're working with the Department of Justice to bring someone in to work with the law enforcement agencies and come up with a strategy. This is a very challenging area of the report because you're talking about, you know, six or seven law enforcement agencies that have certain policies in place. For the most part, they don't want to make these types of arrests because it is very time-consuming. It takes an officer out of the street, and really the level of offense doesn't warrant significant action.
Public attitudes on possession of marijuana are changing around the country.
Absolutely.
Have they changed here? Is it an official change of policy or attitude at the police department or within the criminal justice system?
It's still a criminal offense, and we certainly get plenty of cases where individuals are charged with possession of marijuana or possession of drug paraphernalia.
And in most cases, how much are they in possession of?
It's typically a user amount for the possession of marijuana. And truthfully, as I talk about low level and high level, as a prosecutor, I have to decide where to utilize resources. So oftentimes, if it's a young man or woman and it's a first offense, we're giving them an opportunity to do some community service, to go into a program to make certain that they stay in school, to make certain that they get no other record in the next year. And then that case can be dismissed and off their record so that it's not an impediment to go to college or to go get a job. So we're working with lower levels. The problem is if they continue.
Right. If we're spending $11.5 million a year on adjudicating that and possession of drug paraphernalia and driving while license revoked, not under the influence, just because you're – I mean, certainly that's an offense, and they revoked your license for a reason. But how do you approach these things? I mean, these are all offenses.
We've actually, with the help of some others – sought to have a bill introduced to address some of that because the reason why your license is revoked may imply whether or not you are driving around as a danger.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you and I get a speeding ticket mm-hmm. and you pay yours off and I just don't have the money to pay mine off and so a certain period of time goes by, my license gets revoked. Even though we were going the same rate of speed, we had the same driving record, I pose no greater danger to the community than you do. But now my license is revoked. I'm a criminal for driving. And that's one of the things that you know, we have some bills in the legislature hoping to address that. Mm. Because once you get caught in that web, once you're now charged with driving with your license revoked for not paying my ticket, it comes with another year's suspension. And if you live in Chicago, New York, Philly or something, not having a license may not be the impediment it is in Charlotte
right.
to working. And
because we don't have the mass transit option.
That's right.
So because these are laws, state laws, how much leeway does the prosecution have in deciding how to prosecute or not prosecute these situations?
Well,
I
certainly have discretion in any criminal case. So if it is someone, as Kevin just described, typically we will give that person an opportunity to go get their license, to go pay off the fines, to make certain that they get a license and bring back their license, and we will dismiss it. That's why we're spending a lot of time and energy mm-hmm. and resources on trying to get people reinstated and get their license back.
That's Andrew Murray, Charlotte District Attorney. Also with us, Kevin Tully, Mecklenburg County Public Defender, and Tom Eberle, Director of Criminal Justice Services in the Mecklenburg County Manager's Office. We're talking about justice reinvestment and smart justice, among other things, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bilo Supermarket, serving the Southeast for over 50 years, introducing a variety of Czech soda flavors available at Bilo. Store locator, weekly ad, and fuel perks. Program details at buy-low.com. President Obama renews calls to close Guantanamo. Criminal charges are filed against three friends of the Boston bombing suspect. And the latest housing and unemployment numbers. A panel of journalists bringing analysis to those and other stories in the national scene. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Reem Show. Of course, the International Hour at 11. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 1-800-603-WFAE. Or online at wfae.org/ Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Steve, as a host of Morning Edition, you could sit behind the mic in the studio every day. Why do you leave the studio?
Because to know a story, you need to see it. Meet people for myself, because that is the way that you learn, and it's at the heart of what we do at NPR's Weekday News Magazine. We're getting out to look at the story, bring it back to you, and share what we've learned on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Comprehensive, in-depth morning news, weekdays from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Tom Eberle from Mecklenburg County's Manager's Office, Director of Criminal Justice Services there. Andrew Murray is the Charlotte District Attorney, and Kevin Tully is in the Mecklenburg County Public Defender's Office. Something came up in the break that probably not a lot of people know about. We were just talking about how we're spending $11.5 million a year to adjudicate cases involving possession of marijuana and possession of drug paraphernalia. Drug paraphernalia could be rolling papers to roll marijuana. It could be a needle to inject heroin. It could be a bong to smoke marijuana. But possession of drug paraphernalia is a greater offense than possession of marijuana itself, correct?
Yes, it's a class one misdemeanor, which is the highest offense in misdemeanors, and the marijuana possession is a class three misdemeanor.
And there's no difference in the eyes of the law between carrying a pack of rolling papers, which could be used to roll tobacco, than a needle.
Well, I have to clarify, just having rolling papers in your pocket with nothing else, there has to be some nexus to drugs.
Okay.
So if there had to be some drugs there or some indication that drugs were being used as those papers. But yes, as Kevin says, possession of marijuana is a low level. There is another class 1A, one above one, but there's four classes. And possession of paraphernalia, there's no distinguishment. So it could be a blade to cut cocaine. It can be a crack pipe. And it has a higher level than simply possessing the marijuana.
A plastic baggie.
A plastic baggie is drug paraphernalia?
Yes, sir.
If it has a nexus to marijuana, if it has a little residual about around it where there's a baggie in one pocket and marijuana in the other, it has some nexus to it.
If your marijuana is in a plastic baggie, you can get more jail time, three times as much jail time for the baggie than the marijuana.
Is that peculiar to North Carolina, or is that something?
I hope so.
You found the approximately half of all offenders released from the county jail are rearrested within a year, and the Mecklenburg County is one of the top two places in the state where those released from state prison decide to locate when they get out. Did you decide that a program needed to be in place to deal with those people? I mean, is there a program that you've come up with to deal with this?
Yes, we're actually trying to work with the state to create a reentry model that individuals leaving the state institutions could access. You know, it would involve assessing these individuals actually before they leave the institution, figuring out what kind of services they need, coordinate those services, and then maybe hopefully eventually we'll create a resource center for the people leaving the state institutions. With the jail, the sheriff's been fantastic in developing programming within the jail, and his recidivism numbers are going down.
Why is it that I'm sure that Disney World's very happy that when prisoners get out of state prison, they don't say, where are you going? Disney World. They say Charlotte. Why is Charlotte the destination that they
It's because that's where they came from.
Really? Is it most of the prisoners in state prison are coming from here?
They're coming home.
Okay.
If you also think about it, the job opportunities and things like that, Charlotte is a draw for people who are looking to make a new start.
Yeah, I would tell you it's no different than everyone else that's looking for jobs. We're a growing market. We're a great city. And so even though it's difficult for somebody who has a criminal conviction, this is at least a larger city and opportunity to try to find work.
So let's take a look at some of the things that you've done to improve the criminal justice system here, and some of them you've already alluded to somewhat, but you've set up specialized prosecution teams. You talked about that, Andrew Murray. How do they operate? How do they improve the system?
Well, for domestic violence is really a scourge of this community and of the entire state, and there were over 100 deaths related to domestic violence throughout the state last year. So we set up a domestic violence team. That team simply deals with only domestic violence cases. They're unique. They understand victims. Victims are difficult to deal with. Victims have been traumatized. Many victims, that's their lifeline. They have no other income but for the offender. And so our prosecutors understand the networking with domestic violence, how to get victims help, how to get them into systems where they can break the cycle and get some financial assistance while they break that cycle, and also for the offenders to get them some treatment to also try to break the cycle. If we can break that cycle of domestic violence, we are protecting not only the victim, but we are protecting a whole group, the children that are involved, family members that are involved, and stopping that cycle from continuing for others. We also do it in the habitual felon team I have. We simply target those that have three prior offenses for felony offenses. For three times, they have committed felonies, have been sentenced, and then they commit again and they commit again. After the third time, the amount of exposure for jail time goes up significantly, and a lot of those individuals need to go to jail because they just are not conforming and they're harming a lot of citizens in this community. So we're targeting them. We're indicting everyone that's a habitual offender. We're indicting everyone. That doesn't mean we convict everyone depending on their background, their record, but we're indicting everyone and we're taking a hard look at who needs to go off to prison for a long time.
Kevin?
Yeah, I was going to say I think we're blessed in Mecklenburg County that they recognize that funding just one side of the equation in the adversarial system doesn't work. And when I began talking about, you know, going into this with some concerns, if you do something like that, you build a habitual felon prosecution team, but you don't do anything on the other side, it can very quickly become a railroad. And there was a lot of concern, railroad for the defendant,
right,
railroaded into prison. There was a lot of concern from our side on that. And the county did help us build a habitual felon defense team. And by virtue of that, even despite –
What is the defense for that, though?
You could ask Mr. Frazier, Ms. Jackson, and I think Mr. St. Aubin has worked in that group, Mr. Singalese. But they had a run of 13 jury trials in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Where members of the public said no and did not convict the person as a habitual felon.
Was that jury nullification or was it something else that worked there?
It was the jury making a decision, each individual. So it was 12 people. I can't speak for any one of those jurors on any one of those cases.
Right.
Some of those were not guilty of the offense. Some of them were not guilty as a habitual felon.
And yet yesterday, I believe I read this, the budget for the district attorney's office is about four times what it is for the public defender's office.
And I'm not going to say that's disproportionate in the sense that they handle all of the criminal matters in Mecklenburg County from the prosecution end. We do not handle all of the defense end.
Okay. You've also been able to speed up the time it takes for cases to make their way through the courts through the criminal case management plans or through criminal case management plans. How did it work before and how does it work now? What are these plans? Who wants to take that? Go ahead.
I'll take that. Prior to the plan that was in place, it really was up to the district attorney's office to figure out where they wanted to plug in cases on a docket. What we've done is we've moved that responsibility with the DA's approval to the trial court administrator. And what they've essentially done is they've hired three positions that manage the docket.
Mm-hmm.
And they serve as docket cops. And they're making sure that the cases are being processed in a timely manner and trying to reduce all the continuances that were occurring in the past. And so it's really just trying to make sure things move along. And it's really been quite successful. Case disposition times have decreased 39% since we implemented the plan. And even more importantly, crimes against persons cases have been cut in half in terms of the time it takes to dispose of those.
And how is this different from the fast tracking that you talked about?
Well, this is just regular cases. Fast tracking, we're meeting early and often on cases where we know it can be resolved early and that someone can just get credit for times already served or get probation, get along. These are cases that are moving along in our system. And now we basically have an independent arbitrator, being a trial court administrator, that are holding accountable, holding my office accountable, saying, are you ready? Do you have all the evidence? Have you provided it to Defense County? Are you ready to go? And keeping us accountable, and also keeping defense accountable, saying, you've got all of the evidence. You should be ready to go. And next month, this case is going on the calendar, and everybody should be ready, and pushing both sides. And if there's a dispute in that, then you go in front of a judge, and the judge is the final decision maker on when that case. But it is keeping everybody accountable, everybody on track to get rid of cases as quickly as possible.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of calls from folks and get their questions asked and answered. Gene in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. I am a mediator, and I have a question with the District Criminal Court mediation system as to why the defendants are forced to use the City of Charlotte mediators, who are free mediators, and are not given the opportunity to select their own mediator, just like they can select their own attorney. In Superior Court cases, the parties can select their own mediator. If they do not select the mediator within 21 days of being on the case being on the court calendar, the clerk selects the mediator off a roster list, but they're all independent mediators. It looks like it'd be a conflict of interest for the state to charge a person, then also force that person to use the government's mediator.
Who can take that?
Well, I think there's two things going on. This is Kevin Tully. I think in Superior Court, when you talk about mediation, that is civil court. If there's mediation that you're talking about going on in criminal court, there's a very brand new statute that is addressing criminal charges that do not involve law enforcement, but simply are citizen-driven complaints. And there was it's a brand new system where the county can elect to have the defendant and the prosecuting witness sit down through mediation. How that came about as to the choice of who was going to do the mediation, I don't know.
And seems like an inherent conflict of interest for if I'm charged with a crime, that then when I go to court, I have the choice of selecting an attorney or a court-appointed attorney, and a court-appointed attorney is picked off a roster, but they are independent companies or individuals. Mm-hmm. But now I'm forced to use a mediator that is selected by the same government that's prosecuting me, that is controlled by the City of Charlotte, okay. And that looks like you don't have to. It can be new judge legislation, but still it's a conflict of interest, and maybe you need to go back and look at it and allow these defendants also to have the choice of selecting their own mediator or to have the City of Charlotte or to use the City of Charlotte mediators. But I'm just saying, just because the legislation's there doesn't mean it's constitutional, that it's ever been tested in court, and you don't have to have a law degree to understand a conflict of interest.
Well, this is Andrew Murray. I work for the state, and I work for the citizens of this community for the state. And when there is a mediator being selected, they don't work for me. I don't know the mediators. The mediators work for the county and the county – oh, I'm sorry, Mr.
The Everly. City. They work for the city.
The mediators work for the city, and they are simply there to try to resolve matters so that we're not continuing to push cases through the system that costs the taxpayers a lot of money if they can be resolved at an early level in the proceeding. So I say there's no conflict. They don't work for me. I don't know them. I work for the state. I prosecute from the state. And having some mediator that's a licensed mediator from the city doesn't concern me at all.
Gene, thank you for your call. Let me move on to Rich in Charlotte. You're on WFAE, Rich.
My question, this is also a conflict of interest. My question is regarding the marijuana tax, which I understand is civil, but here you have police officer makes an arrest. He weighs the marijuana or whatever controlled substance he confiscates. He then informs the Department of Revenue that, yeah, we've got, say, for argument's sake, 10 pounds of marijuana. The Department of Revenue makes an assessment based on that 10 pounds that the police department give them. And they go to the person's house, they take everything they own, they hit them with this tax assessment, which they say is civil, there's no due process, there's no judge, there's no way to fight it. It's like a kangaroo court. And then the safer argument...
Rich, your question is, because I'm short on time.
If these charges are dismissed, you're still stuck with the taxes. Now,
Okay. Anyone want to take that? Because I'm really short on time.
I'll try real quickly. My experience has been that when you get the notice that the tax is being assessed, there is a some information on how to request a hearing on it. And that has to be in writing within a certain period of time, I think within 30 days, and that triggers your due process.
I know that. Thank you for your call, Rich. I wish we had more time, but we do not. You set up a bunch of different specialty courts, drug treatment, mental health, domestic violence courts, to name a few. Why are these better equipped to handle these cases than just the standard courts?
Well, you get subject matter experts that understand the caseload, that where I can develop those that have been doing the case a long time with those that young that we're training. We have a lot of turnover because I can't pay my attorneys a whole lot. Mm-hmm. So it keeps a certain synergy within the teams, and it just makes us better because we're able to reach out to the different stakeholders that are involved in that. That is, if it's in child sex cases, there are those that are geared towards helping children, to evaluating children. And so we maintain those relationships, and I believe we do it much better because of that.
So the aim of all of this has been to make the court system more effective, the criminal justice system more effective, to cost less money to the taxpayers, to reduce recidivism and promote client success, clients being the those being prosecuted, client success in the community. Any hard figures on how this has gone so far?
Well, so far, we're very pleased with the results. I mean, to me, the biggest indicator is the jail itself. I mean, we're on the verge of starting a construction of that $300 million facility, and the fact that, you know, we've turned the jail population around, I think speaks volumes to the work that's been done.
And for private warrant court, where individual takes out a charge against the individual, as your caller indicated, we are actually having a mediator early on, with having those two parties meet with the mediator, and we're resolving many, many cases before they go any further in the system, saving numerous taxpayer dollars and resources.
And that's Andrew Murray, Charlotte District Attorney, Tom Eberle, Director of Criminal Justice Services in the Mecklenburg County Manager's Office, and Kevin Tully was also with us, Mecklenburg County's Public Defender. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.